Welcome to another AAT Employment Taxes podcast. This one, the second in the series covering 2011-12 payroll year-end obligations. The first payroll year-end podcast looked at preparing for payroll year-end and at registering or logging on for online filing. In this podcast, I want to look at certain PAYE aspects and potential errors that can be corrected by carrying out some checks before we are ready to submit the end-of-year PAYE returns. The deadline for payment of any outstanding PAYE income tax, Class 1 National Insurance contributions, student loan or construction industry scheme deductions is the 19th or 22nd of April 2012. Although the 21st and 22nd is a weekend, therefore payment needs to reach the HMRC bank account by Friday the 20th of April 2012. This is a whole month before the statutory deadline of 19th May 2012 for the submission of the PAYE returns. And it is 3 months before the payment of Class 1A National Insurance contributions are due in relation to the 2011-12 P11Ds that will be submitted with entries in the cash equivalent brown boxes. However, there is a potential liability for Class 1 National Insurance contributions in respect of any expenses, payments or benefits included in the blue boxes on the P11Ds. This might be school fees reported in the blue box at Section M or taxable vouchers reported at Section C of the P11D. The Class 1 NIC's liability should have been paid in the earnings period when the liable expenses, benefits, vouchers, etc. were given to the employees, and the Class 1 National Insurance contributions must be put through the payroll and paid by the 19th or 20th of April 2012. We also need to reconcile the amount of PAYE income tax, Class 1 National Insurance contributions, student loan or CIS deductions due for 2011-12 against the payments actually made to HMRC, and this needs to be done before the submission deadlines for the PAYE and P11D returns. There may be a need to make some additional payments. The P30B payslip booklet contains an additional payslip to enable us to make any extra payment. My end-of-year PAYE check will also consider possible errors on the payroll, such as the wrong tax code number being operated, and other more potentially expensive errors that can occur off the payroll. The issue of gross payments for casual labour and payments to individual workers treated as self-employed, as well as round sum expense payments and untaxed termination payments, all need consideration at this time of year. A final check should be made before closing the payroll down, because this might save a lot of money in the long run. Section 2, Review of Payslip and Tax Codes. We must remember that employers have an obligation to operate PAYE and that tax must be deducted in accordance with a tax code in notice issued by HMRC or in accordance with the PAYE regulations. This might be using the tax code on the P45 given to the employer when a new employee joins. But if a new employee is unable to provide a P45 from the former employer, or if the new employee had no former employment, the P46 procedure must be used by the employer to determine the correct code number to be used. There are also other circumstances where the employee must refer to the PAYE regulations in order to decide what tax code number to use for the particular employee. This can be when an employee starts to receive an occupational pension but continues working for the employer, and also when an employee leaves and receives a payment after the date of termination of the employment and issue of the P45. A review of payslip and tax codes, particularly non-standard income tax codes, is something that I would carry out every year. But for 2011-12, it is, in my view, even more important than usual. This is because the pay-as-you-earn regulations brought in a significant change on the 6th of April 2011. This required employers to use code 0T instead of code basic rate, code BR, in certain circumstances. This change affected new employees without a P45, employees receiving an occupational pension whilst continuing to work for the same employer, and payments made to an employee after leaving the employment. I will look at each situation in turn. First, let's consider when a new employee doesn't have a P45 and doesn't complete a Form P46 at Statement A or B. In such circumstances, the employer is required to deduct tax using code 0T on a non-cumulative basis. Previously, code basic rate would only deduct tax at the basic rate of tax, which is 20%, and that is irrespective of the amount of the earnings or the pension. However, code 0T deducts tax at the basic, higher, and additional rates as appropriate when necessary, depending, of course, on the various bands. The 20% band from 0 to 35,000, the higher rate band from £35,001 up to £150,000, and the additional rate of 50% band for all income above £150,000. So, for example, a new employee without a P35 earns £10,000 in the first month of employment. If code basic rate would have been used, it would have deducted £2,000 tax, which of course is £10,000 times 20%. In contrast, if code 0T month 1 basis was used, which is what has been required since the 6th of April 2011, the amount of tax deducted would be £3,416.66. Yes, that's right, £1,416.66 more tax than would have been deducted by code basic rate. The potential for an employer to have failed to deduct sufficient pay-as-you-earn tax is pretty obvious, isn't it? Secondly, when an employee receives income from an occupational pension while still in the same employment, and this is becoming more common for employees to carry on working after they reach pension age, in these circumstances, the employer is required to operate code 0T on a non-cumulative basis against the pension payments, thus preventing the duplication of personal allowances. Before 6th of April 2011, employers were required to operate the existing tax code of the employee on both the employment income and the new pension payments. This would duplicate personal allowances and would almost certainly result in an underpayment of tax at the year end, unless, of course, the employee was on a K code. If an employer has used the old system, then someone on code 747L or basic personal allowances would have £275.20 deducted per month from the pension instead of £400 that would be deducted using code 0T non-cumulative basis. So you can see this would create an underpayment of £124.80 per month until the correct code number was operated. Well, next, let's consider what should happen when an employee receives payments from their employer after they've left. Previously, if an employee received a payment from their employer after the employment had ceased and the P45 had been issued, the payment would not have been included on the individual's P45 and the employer would have been required to deduct tax at the basic rate, or 20%. However, as I've already said, code OT non-cumulative should have been used since the 6th of April 2011. Take the example of someone receiving a post-termination payment of up to £2,916. Code OT month 1 and code BR would deduct the same amount of tax, i.e. £583.20. This is because £2,916 is 1/12 of the basic rate band of £35,000 for 2011-12. Payments over £2,916 would result in an underpayment arising because of the 40% tax ban that would kick in. Someone receiving a post-termination payment in excess of just £12,500 would begin to pay tax at 50% on part of that payment. Clearly, employers need to check that they did use code OT on a non-cumulative basis for new joiners without a P45, for pensioners with an occupational pension, and for post-termination payments. Another check we should make is to ensure that the tax code on the P14 is the final tax code for the year. Please remember that you should not change code 0T back to the previous tax code that was used before the employee left. It is the final tax code that should be shown. Now let's consider whether any employees on code NT, which is no tax, have been correctly treated. For perhaps most employers, the most common use of code NT may have been for student employees, where PAYE procedures allow an employer to operate code NT and not deduct tax from payments made to student workers. This is on the basis they only work for the employer in the school holidays. My immediate concern is to check that the paperwork has been completed, because code NT should only be used for a student that has completed the declaration on form P38S, the declaration which confirms that he or she is a student and will be until the 5th of April 2012, in other words, at the end of the tax year. The declaration also confirms that the total earnings will not exceed £7,475, the personal allowance limit. Code NT can only then be applied, and income tax does not have to be deducted unless the earnings exceed the personal allowance limit of £7,475. Next question, has that monetary limit been monitored? Because tax should have been deducted on any amount paid to the student in excess of £7,475. The Pay As You Earn regulations require that code 0T is applied to any payments over £7,475. As I've said, the student should be asked to complete the student declaration when they're first taken on, and a new P38S should be completed at the start of the tax year, which will mean during the Easter holidays this year, as usual. I also want to ask, are all the NT tax codes still valid? If a student was taken on in school holidays and is then allowed to work at other times, such as at the weekends in term time, code NT will no longer be relevant and the P46 procedure should be applied. What about other NT tax codes issued by HMRC? My Gavin and Stacey example is about Gavin being seconded to work for his employer in Belgium for 18 months. And because he is outside the UK for a full tax year in an employment, HMRC will issue a no tax code. However, if an employee returns home early, the no tax code would no longer be relevant. Have any employees in this situation been switched from code NT to a more appropriate tax code? Have any other employees returned from overseas where code NT had previously been issued? And has that code been changed? It is a common sense step at the end of the year to check any non-standard tax codes and ensure that they are still appropriate. Section 3, casual labour. The P38A Employer Supplementary Return is a statutory end-of-year PAYE return, which is required to report details of any worker who has been employed, but where the employer has not submitted a P14 end-of-year summary or completed and retained a student form P38S. HMRC's Employer Helpbook E13 tells us that an employee is anyone who is employed under a contract of service, and that this includes someone who is a full-time, part-time, or a casual worker. It says that if the employee does not give you a P45 because they claim to be self-employed, look at the terms on which you took them on, and if you are in any doubt, ask your HMRC office for help, which of course most employers will be reluctant to do. However, the employer should treat the individual as an employee until the situation is clarified. There is a minimum recording requirement for PAYE, and the employer must keep a record of the name, the address, and the wages paid to the worker in each pay period. The PAYE threshold for 2011-12 is £144 per week, or £623 per month. But we must remember the limit becomes only £1 if a new employee, including a casual employee, has not provided a P45 from their former employer, or has not completed Box A or B of the Form P46. Box C on the P46 is confirmation of either another job, estate or occupational pension, and code 0T non-cumulative should then be used to deduct tax. There is such a thing as a true casual, which is someone who's taken on for 1 week or less with no expectation of working again. In those circumstances, we may not have to operate pay as you earn, but we do have to keep a record of the name, address, and the amounts paid to the worker. So let's turn to what controls have existed to ensure that pay as you earn has been operated and that the appropriate records have been kept. Is there a need to obtain more information about casual workers? Perhaps retrospectively obtaining forms P46, or at least their address details if they were true casuals. Has evidence been obtained of the right of any foreign workers to work in the UK? The Home Office UK Border Agency does require checks to be made on foreign workers coming to the UK to work, and potentially severe penalties and even prison sentences could be imposed for failing to keep the appropriate paperwork and therefore potentially employing illegal workers. It is a serious issue and one that needs to be addressed. What types of payments should we be looking at? Payments to window cleaners are generally accepted as payments to the self-employed. But payment to an office cleaner will be treated as employees. Cleaners will be treated as employees except when they're cleaning domestic properties. Do we have, or can we now get assigned P46 to remove or reduce the potential liability? Or do we need to include any workers, casual or otherwise, on the payroll before it's closed down? Casual bar staff working in pubs, clubs, etc. often involve people with second jobs where tax should have been deducted using code 0T non-cumulative. Some casual workers may be able to sign a P46 if they've not already done so, and it may not be too late to get that signed P46. We should certainly be looking at this. Section 4, Employment Status. I've always told AAT members that employment status is a top target for HMRC, and recently I've been pointing out that there are a lot of reviews taking place at the moment. The key point is that the risk is virtually one-sided and that it lies with the employer making the gross payments. The failure to operate PAYE and deduct Class 1 national insurance contributions can be a very expensive mistake. My standard example to show AAT members is the self-employed individual who is paid £600 per week in 2011-12. A self-employed person would pay Class 2 national insurance of £2.50 a week or £130 a year. The Class 4 NIC that would be paid on that amount of income would be £2,157.75, giving us a total of Class 2 and 4 NICs of just under £2,300. However, if HMRC employer compliance or status officers come along and prove that the correct status or categorisation is employee, the Class 1 national insurance contributions that will be due would total £6,206.20. A potential national insurance contribution recovery of £3,918.45 for one employee for 1 year. Multiply that by 4 years and we're up to nearly £16,000. two employees, over £30,000. For six employees, we're coming up to nearly £200,000. It can be an expensive business. And that doesn't include the pay as you earn. Pay as you earn at the basic rate on £600 a week would amount to £6,240. The employer might end up paying that as well, especially if the so-called self-employed person hasn't joined the club and hasn't paid any tax. I would argue to set off the Class 2 and 4 national insurance contributions paid by the worker, and perhaps some, if not all, of the tax paid by the worker also, but that is assuming that the worker paid the tax and or national insurance contributions in the first place. My advice at this time of year is to look at any contract, engagement letter, or anything else that indicates the terms and conditions of the engagement, and to check the method and frequency of payment. Too many individuals are paid as self-employed when they're clearly employed with regular hours and payments. We can use HMRC's Employment Status Indicator tool to check, and at least we should do this when there is any doubt. If the Employment Status Indicator tool confirms self-employment status, then I will want to keep a copy of that result as a permanent record to show an HMRC officer in the future. If the result says employed status, I would have to consider with my client whether to put the worker on the payroll or look at whether we can change the terms and conditions in order to strengthen the case for self-employment. But it certainly needs looking at. Section 5, termination payments. The treatment of any termination payments made in 2011-12 might also be usefully reviewed at this time. Let's start with the tax payments made after the date of leave-in and look at whether the employer correctly used code 0T on a non-cumulative basis, or perhaps was unaware of the change from the 6th of April 2011 and only deducted tax at the basic rate. As explained earlier in the podcast, an underpayment will arise if a payment was made in excess of £2,916, because some 40% tax liability will arise. Tax-free termination payments are a bigger potential problem, especially where so many employers just assume that the first £30,000 is tax-free, when it often isn't. We should therefore review any untaxed payments made in 2011-12 and consider whether any of those payments should now be put through the payroll before it's closed down. Genuine payments of compensation or damages should be exempt up to the £30,000 tax limit. But of course, there's no limit for national insurance purposes. Either the payment is earnings or it's not. Statutory redundancy payments are always exempt, providing, of course, it was a genuine redundancy, not a retirement, or someone left and was replaced, or some other reason for the payment, but it was called redundancy. The statutory redundancy limit increased from £400 per week to £430 per week from the 1st of February 2012. There is a statutory redundancy payment calculator on the Direct Gov website if you need to check this. Payments in lieu of notice and ex gratia payments really do need careful consideration and are what I've always called potential minefield issues. This is where professional advice should be sought before making any tax-free payments. But we do need to look at this now. Section 6, other potential pay-as-you-earn liabilities. Again, at this time of year, I want to look at anything where there's a possible failure to operate pay-as-you-earn and other payments that may result in payments of income tax, Class 1 national insurance contributions, interest and penalties to HMRC, will include round sum allowances or per diems that are not covered by a dispensation, that have not been agreed in advance with HMRC. What about non-receipted expenses? Tim and I are always telling AAT members that expenses should be receipted where possible. But the lack of receipts can end up in a lack of control and people claiming expenses that they've never incurred. Mobile phone and Oyster card top-ups or other round sum payments can cause a problem if there's no evidence of the expenditure. Home to work travel reimbursement and other personal expenses, again, can give rise to pay-as-you-earn liabilities if the employer is reimbursing personal expenses, not business expenses. Section 7, summary. The operation of pay-as-you-earn is compulsory, not optional, and as well as the minimum recording requirement of name, address, and the amounts paid in each pay period, employers have to follow procedures, deduct pay-as-you-earn when appropriate, keep the required records, and submit annual statutory returns. In this podcast, we've considered some potential problems with the operation of the payroll, reviewing non-standard tax codes and considering the requirements for operating PAYE in relation to student and casual workers. Also the issue of the employment status of workers. Some of the payments that need to be reviewed will be paid outside of the payroll. The rules for pay-as-you-earn and national insurance contributions are different, and a separate podcast will therefore look at certain NIC aspects for review before submitting the 2011-12 pay-as-you-earn returns. I hope this podcast has been useful to you. Thank you.